I sold my car in Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Taking stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's programme, why are workers increasingly prioritising flexibility, purpose and well-being over pay rises? We'll also examine the growing global tensions around tariffs and protectionism with the author of a new book called How to Win a Trade War. Plus, why are so few Irish companies using the R&D tax credit, despite it being one of the state's key innovation incentives? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my explainer this week, I wanted to talk about what an oligopsony is, while picking up on one of the biggest stories of the past 2 days, namely Trump's visit to China. So an oligopsony is where one party controls a bottleneck in the global supply chain that gives them huge economic leverage. Now, rare earths aren't what you think they are. First off, they are a group of 17 metallic elements, and they have unique magnetic, luminescent and electrochemical properties that make them essentially irreplaceable in modern technology. However, they're not rare in the Earth's crust, but they are rare in extracting and refining them to actually use them economically. That's the rare bit. Now, here is how it links back to an oligopsony. China controls roughly 60 to 70% of global mining and about 85 to 90% of global refining capacity. So these rare earths are critical inputs into EV batteries, wind turbines, smartphones, MRI machines, semiconductors, defence hardware. And naturally, these matter to the US and indeed all of us. And that's why this oligopsony situation was one of the top priorities at this summit. Now, the world of recruitment is changing. We see AI CVs, we see work-life balance, and of course, perhaps the change around Pizza Fridays are making the process a little bit more complicated for employers and indeed employees. To unpack some of the current challenges on both sides of the recruitment lines, we're now joined by Gillian Knight, MD of Cala Management Solutions. Gillian, I want to first of all ask you about probationary management. As we chronologically look at the way in which people are working in the workplace today, they need to start off under probation in order to see how things settle. What mistakes do you see companies making in this regard?
I think probation in Ireland is now a legislative requirement that if you want to let someone go during a probationary period or even through the first year of employment, you have to have that explicit in their contracts of employment. So what I'm seeing is that one, people say, I'm letting someone go because they're on probation, but they never actually specify that they were on probation. So without it being specified, they're not actually on it. So that's one mistake. Lack of policies, contractual agreements on the same. And for those that do, the common one would be 6 months probation. For probation in Ireland to be legal, if you want to do an exit for an employee, you have to show what's required of them, where they are against that requirement. And when they have any deviation from that, that you give them ample opportunity, training and support where necessary to bridge those gaps in advance of an exit.
So, Gillian, does that mean that all of the emphasis then lies on the employer?
Oh, for sure. Like, the employee obviously has to perform. So the employee has to do what's required of them, but they have to know exactly what is required of them.
And if they're going to be let go during probation, then the evidence that they didn't meet those requirements needs to be clear.
It needs to be very clear, explicit in writing. So a probationary management system needs to be in place. The employer needs to prove that they have shown this is what is required of you, A, B, C, D. This is where they are against that, and give them ample opportunity, as I said, in a reasonable time frame. Not you need to do this by tomorrow. It needs to be reasonable.
you know, there's been a lot of things that have moved in your world of HR. Like, we've seen auto-enrollment come in. Of course, there's been changes around sick pay. There's been lots of different developments in different areas. And of course, then that is different to the cultural shifts that we've seen around COVID and so on. How would you characterise the role of employers today in terms of what they don't know, what sort of blind spots they might have?
I think that still employers are focused on basic salary as a way to attract and retain people. And the workforce now wants more than that. It would show that around 70% of employees will turn over for career progression opportunities. So they'll go for career progression against maybe the remuneration side of things, which would be a far lower percentage. Around 10 to 19% of a workforce will change hands every year, and that would usually be within the first year of employment. And most people will leave employment nowadays for better career opportunities, as I said. But also, there's a new increase of around 35-7% that people leave due to work-life balance conflicts. And this is something that employers just aren't getting the memo on it. And I suppose what would that look like is non-financial rewards in your reward package. Don't just focus on basic salary. People want more.
Well, I want to go back to the first one you made there. If 70% of people would change due to career progression as distinct to salary, but doesn't usually career progression come with salary?
Not necessarily. A lot of people now I'm coming across, we still, you know, due to nature of my role, I still do a lot of recruitment, and people will come to us and take a reduction in salary, sometimes a significant one, for a better work-life balance, for more enjoyable work, more meaningful work.
Ah, so when I heard you say career progression, I used the term in my head, promotion. Am I getting that wrong?
Exactly. I think that what we would think as career progression can have very different meanings now. You know, if you talk about the public sector or a hierarchical structure where there's defined lines, then perhaps that model would be the old definition. But now it's not as simple as that. And a lot of businesses don't have this hierarchical triangular circle, you know, set system in place. It's more flat level structure. And it's about what you're doing on the day to day, the meaning behind it, and the value added maybe to the environment, to society. These are things that people value now more than ever.
When you talk about meaning and value add, I sometimes wonder, as an employer myself, whether we try to insulate staff too much from the outcome. We try to protect them from getting things wrong, or, you know, if a difficult email comes in or so on like that, we might tend to stand up and take the rap so that that ricochet effect doesn't happen. But of course, if we do that, then that also stops them from getting the good stuff too. Do we, being employers, connect our employees enough to the outcome, do you think?
I think it's a difficult one, because if I hire, for example, a qualified, trained, experienced person, that level of responsibility will be expected because it will be commensurate with their remuneration package, you know, and what that looks like. I think for junior staff, we require handholding. I think it is responsible and necessary. But as someone moves up in their experience and their skill level, then we should allow them fail, in essence, albeit with a structured program that it can't be dramatic, you know, as in a client issue, you know, at a later stage. But we do need to let people some scope to fail.
I think a great phrase is that failure has to be okay as long as it's not repeated.
Exactly.
Because then it gets entrenched, of course, and that's different. I also then want to go to your next statistic there that you shared with us. 10 to 19%, you said, of a workforce will change hands. How is that in comparison to previous times? Like, is that high level or low level, neutral?
I think that the stats that came back from 2025 was that just over a quarter of the workforce experienced increased employee turnover. That would be very high. You know, the usual percentages would come in around 12%. So I think that the employers are feeling it maybe twice as much as they would have in the past. And I think in olden days, you would have seen a CV and you would have valued that someone stayed somewhere a long time. And now, actually, that could be a deterrent on a CV. We may view the person as stale or as institutionalized or lacking some dynamism. So I think the workforce in general has changed, and employers' attitudes are changing, just albeit a little bit slower.
And here's why I don't quite understand how, at this moment in time, we can trust an AI to interview somebody, because I would, in my situation, like to hear about somebody if they're there 5 years or 15 years to discern myself whether it is stale or whether it's loyalty, or maybe they changed jobs several times within that company, but the reason that they stayed with that company was for that reason. What's your take on the role of AI interviewing specifically, not CVs now or monitoring, but interviewing itself, Gillian?
I wouldn't agree with it for a number of reasons. I think the primary one is that a fit of a person can be a feeling, and it's on both sides of the table. And you need to, you know, visit that premises, see the people, see how they move around the premises, introduce them. They need to ask questions that an algorithm might not pick up, you know. And I would always say that the biggest issue about probation issues is that the employee didn't know what they were getting into. So it's really important that at the recruitment stage, you highlight what you want of the person, what this place looks like, what their job is going to be. And AI just can't do that yet. So I think that employees should be comfortable to ask normal questions. Like, if I need to leave early to bring my child to ballet, could I leave 10 minutes early? That could come off as a negative question with AI. And an employer might find it okay, you know, and you could actually lose a good employee. But I think we need to be very real about what we have on offer, so that when the employee joins, the biggest thing I get on exit interviews is, it wasn't what I thought it would be. You know, they didn't sell the job correctly, and the employee got a misconception of what they're taking on, you know.
But when you say they didn't sell the job correctly, do you mean contractually or do you mean culturally or both?
Contractually, it's explicit. You know, you're going to start on this date with this job title, with this salary. You know, there's the legislation around the times of your terms of employment. Legislation is very explicit and black and white. So, yeah, it would be more around the culture, how it fits. I kind of use the example sometimes of, if you were going for a job in a pub, you know, and they played heavy metal all the time and you don't like heavy metal, it should have been told to you at the start. So if you went for a job in a pub where it's playing Irish music, you know, and we get a lot of tourists, you should express that, because it could be, you know, the day to day could be really damaged by that. So it's, who are our clients? What sort of pace is expected here? These are things that should be in the job spec, and especially delivered in an interview. So the person has a really good feel, and busy isn't a unit of measure. Big isn't a unit of measure. You need to be explicit about what that means, more descriptive, because those words are very different to different people.
That's true. One person's busy could be another person's peace. And the third number you mentioned here, I don't want to question the number, but I want to question what the context of it was. You said 35 to 37% of people have a concern around work-life balance conflicts. What, because I'm going to be explicit now here and ask, what are work-life balance conflicts?
So a lot of the time as we move through employment, our circumstances change. And the most common one would be around children. And that would be the one that we're most familiar with. So when someone has a child, they perhaps want to work less hours, shorter working days, or part-time hours, working 3 days a week over five, etc. So it's when the employer cannot have flexibility with regard to their new arrangements. Sometimes people assume it's all childcare related, but it's not. You have workers then when they hit their 40s, 50s even, where they're taking care of elderly parents, loved ones. And now what's presenting even is that people want some work-life balance around pets. You know, the pets are their new family. Mm-hmm. I think that it is anything that conflicts with your life outside of work.
And I have to ask then, how do you balance that well where... And by the way, the pets one, I think certainly we do hear more and more of that. And I think there's a lot of merit to it as well. But what advice do you have for employees to ask for this in the right way, where they understand the requirements of the business, but they also want to make sure that they have indeed work-life balance, and where they can meet the employer where they're at?
I think there's a huge amount that your earnings are contingent on your tax brackets. So for someone working 4 days a week against five, the take-home pay can actually be very little difference. And then they have an increased work-life balance. So always with an employer, I say, think about, does this work? let the employee ask. There's no harm in asking. Just let them ask. All you have to do is say no. You've no legal obligation to say yes to these requests, which you should hear them out. And I think that some employers are quick to say no, and there's no real rationale for it, and they lose a really strong employee. They've gone to a 4-day working week, and it's been piloted there some years back, and it's had amazing results. The statistics coming back on it are phenomenal. So it's not shown a diminished output based on a 4-day week over 5, to the tune that of a lot of employers are now actually moving to that, and not experienced any diminished revenues or turnover. I think just the key with employers is listen first, consider, and properly consider now. And from an employee perspective, I'd say to employees, don't just ask, you know, the Oliver Twist, can I have some more? Put a business case forward, present it. And I always say, people say, why do women get paid less than men? Men put a business case forward oftentimes for an increase. The women ask. And I think that you need to present the value, get your statistics. With AI now, that'll do the heavy lifting for you. In the past, you had to do it yourself. And just put a business case for anything you propose. What will this look like for the employer? What are the risk factors for the employer? How have you looked to negate those? And the chances of a successful conversation are increased tremendously when you finish the circle for them.
I'd agree with that. But, and I think you could extend that into any scenario where you speak the other person's language, whether it is, as you say, a business case in the case of the employer, but likewise as well for the employer to speak the language of the employee in terms of what matters to them, etc. One word that I expected to hear a lot more of in our conversation today, Gillian, is flexibility. And, we've used other terms for it, but I'm wondering again, a bit like me earlier, making the mistake of thinking career progression equaled promotion. Are we at risk of also thinking that flexibility equals working from home?
I think that the stats are 82%. It changes between 82 and 4, but the stats of the most prominent request for employees is work-life balance is the work from home option, but it's no longer actually viewed as a perk. It's actually just one of those norms now. Okay, so just keep that in mind, but it was a perk and now it's not post-COVID. So it's almost an assumption. But I think that, you know, flexibility is greater than that. It's, can I start early? Can I take a shorter lunch and finish early? Can I work later? You know, and these type of things, especially in urban areas with rush hour traffic. There's a huge cohort of people that say to get into work and be there for 7:30 would be so much easier than 9. And if I could leave then at 3:30, my working day would be the same hours, but it would really, really give me more free time, you know, because of, I'm not sitting in traffic. But I would say flexibility is a two-way stream, because there's oftentimes your employer will like flexibility. And what I'm experiencing is mostly good employers, to be fair. But sometimes employers are expecting flexibility from the employee but won't do it in return. So it's a two-way stream, you know.
It's intriguing to listen to you, Gillian, and also it's of its time. I'm sure if we were to talk again in a couple of months' time, some element of this that we might be assuming today will change, but that's the world that we live in. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Gillian Knight, Managing Director of Cala Management Solutions.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, Ireland wants to be seen as an innovation economy, so why are so few companies using one of the state's flagship R&D incentives? Now for my trivia. I was working with a group of entrepreneurs in a town this week which has the name of a man in it who guided travellers across the River Shannon in the 10th century, has the oldest pub in Ireland, and the town crossed a border into another county until reunification in 1898. The reunification was of the town, by the way, not anything else. Have a think, and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, R&D is often described as the engine room of long-term economic growth, helping countries drive innovation, productivity and competitiveness. And one of the key tools, and I stress that word, tools, that governments use to encourage that investment is the R&D tax credit. Ireland has long promoted itself internationally as a hub for innovation and high-value enterprise. But despite the availability of a very generous R&D tax credit scheme, only a very small percentage of Irish companies are actually using it. And I want to know why. So we're joined now by Dara Gaffney, Head of R&D Incentives at Leighton Ireland. First off, Dara, the R&D tax credit was introduced in 2004. Can you walk us through how it works?
Yeah, of course I can, Susan. And thank you very much for having me on today. effectively, the incentive is there, and it was brought in, as you said, back in 2004, it was brought in to reaffirm and make those FDI clients that had come into Ireland back in the 70s, 80s and 90s stickier, basically. They had already done a fantastic job of building a very strong manufacturing base in Ireland, but the governments at the time realised that actually without investment in the next generation of talent, the next generation of high-value innovation and high-value jobs, there was a risk that those manufacturing jobs were going to go to lower cost, lower-value jurisdictions as a result. So the R&D tax credit was brought in specifically as an enabler to incentivize those companies to invest in that next generation of research and development.
And let's say that I apply for it. How would I qualify what R&D investment is? I mean, I could go to a conference, Dara, today and I could upskill myself on A, B and C. Does that count?
Sure. And I might take a step backwards, if that's okay, and just give a small bit of context about what the R&D tax credit system is built on and then what companies need to do to make sure they qualify. So the research and development tax credit built back then was actually based on a Canadian model. And the Irish system, very similar to the UK system and a lot of similar systems all across the OECD, is based on what's called the Frascati definition of research and development. Now, that means nothing to you and me, and it will mean nothing to 99% of your listeners. However, there is three key criteria then within the legislation that defines whether the activity you're doing qualifies under the scheme. Okay, so there's actually five, but I'll focus on three for the purposes of this. The first one is that there must be an advancement beyond the state of the art. Okay, so the work you're doing in the business needs to be creating an advancement in the field or in the area that your business operates in.
But does that mean an advancement on what we're doing as a business or better than the industry?
It's both, actually. So, and this is one of the areas that a lot of companies often don't realise straight off the bat, is they believe that what they're doing is not new to the world necessarily, and believe then that actually it does not qualify.
So are companies too hard on themselves then?
They absolutely are. Oh. And I think they often say, well, I don't have employees that either one wear a white lab coat or two are doing research that I might think professors in our academic circles are doing. And that's absolutely, you know, a misnomer out there. If you reshift that perspective and say, actually, it doesn't have to be new to the world, it can be new to me, but if the methodology or the process by which you generate that Me Too product or service is not accessible because it's behind, I don't know, a patent or intellectual property or a trade secret, and you develop a new methodology or a new process to get there, well, then that is as viable to claim under as is something that is also brand new to the world.
And can we talk figures here?
Yeah.
So how does this work? Like, what is a tax credit per se? Is it that one gets money back? Is it that they don't have to pay tax? Walk us through the mechanics of the money.
Yeah, of course. And I suppose that's where the rubber hits the road, really, you know. So since 2022, the government actually changed the scheme slightly. And this was in reaction to the global BEPS rules and the changes to the world taxation that was going on at the time. And basically, it means that Irish companies can choose how they actually receive the tax credit. So you now tick when you're filing your CT1 at the
corporation tax form.
Yeah, sorry, your corporation tax form at whatever time of the year that you file it.
And typically September.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, 27th of September is when 70%, by the way, of all Irish companies are December year ends. So absolutely. You then enter the figures, the R&D tax credit calculations into that, and then you choose whether to take that as a cash injection back into your business or an offset against your corporation tax liability. And one area I'd also just say is that the business needs to be liable for corporation tax, but it does not need to be revenue generating or profitable in order to claim the credit.
But how could I be filing a corporation tax return if I haven't made profit? Because corporation tax is tax on profit.
Sure, but if there's a loss being made within the business, then you may qualify for that cash injection back into the business instead.
Okay, so you can file a corporation tax return where your return, the amount of profit that you make is negative.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And that's actually an area where a number of startups actually miss miss it. In a recent survey, actually, I think 61% of about 700 startups in Ireland surveyed said either one, they weren't aware of the claim, the facility, or two, they just found it too complex to actually file the claim.
Well, let's deal with that, right? Awareness, we're doing something about by talking about it today. But is it too complex? I mean, is this something that you call your accountant and you say, will you take care of this for me now? And then they do their thing? Or is there more to it?
There is more to it, absolutely. And I think if you followed that approach, there is, I would say, 99% of the time your accountant will turn around to you and say, that's too complex, I don't know how to do that. You're going to have to find somebody specialist to actually help you with that. And accountants will often say, guys, revenue is set up to take money off you, not give money back to you.
And this is where I have the question then, which is, and I stress an economic tool, yes, indeed, revenue is there to take money off you, but the government is there to incentivize research and development. So is there a tension between the two?
There's a small tension. I mean, revenue obviously would always argue the fact that, you know, it's their responsibility to stay separate to government departments and enact and enforce the legislation as they see fit. And absolutely, that's absolutely fine. But in terms of what needs to be actually delivered for a successful R&D tax credit claim, absolutely alignment with what you are doing within your business that qualifies under the legislation, that's often where companies get stuck one way or another. And it's where, and I'm not here to do a sales pitch, Susan, but that's where company specialists like ourselves that are specialists in R&D tax credits is all we do. That is our raison d'etre. So in terms of identifying what you do within your business that aligns with the legislation, that's what gives those companies solace as a result.
What percentage of companies are availing of this right now, Dara?
It's massively underutilised. So
how massive?
Yeah, so Ireland actually has the second most generous R&D tax credit scheme within the OECD. I think Portugal is the only jurisdiction that has a more generous scheme, and not by much. In every other jurisdiction where an R&D tax credit scheme exists, approximately 4% of all actively trading companies utilise the scheme. In Ireland, and we're going off 2023 data because that's the latest data that Revenue have published, that's at 0.8%.
So we're not Portugal, and I get that. Yeah. And it is very generous, and I get that. And companies find that it's complex, and I get that. But we're also comprised here of a lot of small companies, a lot of micro companies. I mean, if we were to max this out, what could we be doing? Like, I mean, is this for 10% of companies, do you think? Based on your experience now.
Yeah. I think Irish companies are a lot more innovative and are doing a lot more R&D than they realise that they're doing. So
we're back to the awareness then.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And that misnomer of we don't wear white lab coats, you know, means we don't do R&D within our business. However, you know, you may not have a fully defined research and development project within your business. That doesn't mean that you're not doing R&D at the front end of a product or a service that you're developing, for instance, you know, within your business. You may have a manufacturing business. Nothing in manufacturing is often straightforward. There is often challenges that you need to actually dig into, solve, come up with new solutions. I'm not saying they all qualify under the R&D tax credit scheme, but that's generally the first point to start those creative flow to identify what actually works.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is that one should open their mind before they close it automatically.
Absolutely. And can I go back just to say one thing to you, Susan? So in 23, the value of the tax credit was approximately 1.4 billion is what it was worth to companies out there. 85% of that value was claimed by 15%. There was only 1,800 companies claimed that 1.4 billion. So it has been to now, you know, maximised by the multinational and foreign direct sector. We really want to see SME sectors. And Micheál Martin shouted it out at the start of the year. He said, I don't know what more we can do to encourage the Irish SME base to actually leverage the scheme.
Well, I particularly heard that shout out coming from government the day of the budget when it was announced that even more was going to be available and so on. But I came across that 1.4 billion euro number as well in my research for today. But I know I'm asking you to talk against yourself here, but just 2 years earlier in 2021, that R&D tax credit cost the taxpayer $753 million. In other words, the Irish taxpayer is paying double the amount. Are we getting good value for money, do you think, as taxpayers?
I think we're getting an absolutely massive value for money in terms of this. And just to say, the Irish government have also stated that by 2030, they want that 1.4 billion figure to become 3 billion. So they want to see it double in the next 3.5 years. So there absolutely is that aspiration. And there is data out there that demonstrates, I'll give you two pieces, one from Enterprise Ireland, data that shows companies that invest in research and development within their business are 1.7x more profitable and they generate 4.7x more export sales. That's Enterprise Ireland's own published data. The second part is actually the economic impact of a research and development focused job and the ripple effect that that has in the community in which they live and the economy in which they operate is absolutely significant. I think it's a 3.5x. So for every euro that goes into a research and development tax credit, the economy sees a 3.5x multiplier effect as a result.
And of course, the company themselves see the cash injection or the offset against their tax as well.
Not to mention bringing new products and services to market and creating longer term sustainability within the business, which is obviously what the business wants to do.
I do want to ask you, though, the HMRC in the UK in 2020 came across £1.13 billion in fraudulent or incorrect R&D tax claims. This was up to 16.7% of all claims. I mean, is it also open to abuse?
I would say no, it's not. Not in Ireland. I would say HMRC, and I am not an expert in HMRC and the UK scheme per se, although we absolutely have a base there as well. We would argue that HMRC relaxed the scheme far too much. And actually, they removed all process and controls and made accelerated payments in year one for the R&D tax credit scheme.
So let's say, Dara, the people are listening today and saying, look, I really should be looking into this, right? I've listened to you. They've heard what Micheál Martin said, etc. What practical things should they do right now in order to advance even their exploration of this?
Yeah, I think SME sectors, the managing director quite often is also the technical engine within the business. But I would say absolutely, if it's not something that's come across your radar, educate yourself. I mean, personally, I have a number of blog pieces out there that are easy to access. Don't just listen to me, you know, widen your circle. Talk to a lot of, you know, businesses out there. Obviously, they build off relationships and peer-to-peer. Talk to other people that have leveraged the claim.
And of course, you also need to talk to Revenue to let them know you may be applying for it.
You do, absolutely. So if you have never claimed for the R&D tax credit scheme, you need to notify Revenue 90 days before you file. So obviously, if that's September that you're going to, you're coming up towards it's May time that you need to be notifying Revenue. It's a two-page document. It's not actually that onerous.
Great to talk to you about this, Dara, because it's important we understand the difference between an economic tool, a business support, and the gap between them, particularly if it's not being leveraged in time and sufficiently. So thank you very much for joining me. Dara Gaffney, Head of R&D Incentives at Leighton Ireland.
Thanks very much, Susan.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk. After the break, what does a modern trade war actually look like and who really wins when tariffs and economic nationalism take centre stage? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Well, tariffs, customs arrangements, economic sanctions, bilateral agreements and lots of other international trade jargon has filled newspapers and airwaves over the past couple of years. As Trump's visit to China unfolded this week, many of us were watching out for clues about the trade war between them. However, Soumaya Keynes, economics columnist for the Financial Times and host of the Economic Show podcast for the FT, has the answer to the question, how to win a trade war, in her new book with that very title. First off, Soumaya, it was one of the most accessible economics books I've ever read, I have to say. Your choice of language is very you for a start. But secondly, I noticed that you use a lot of analogies because you said economics is a place where fun goes to die. So will you tell us a little bit about why you chose to write this book in the way that you have written it, first of all, for people who may not be as familiar with economics?
Okay, so just to start with, thank you. That is so nice. And I'm so grateful that you've read it and that you enjoyed it. So I think the way that I approach economics is, you know, I try to bring it to life, right? And it can be this really stuffy, inaccessible, complicated topic. And what people really need to, you know, get a grip of it is stories, right? And so, or images, right? And so that's what I generally try to do. So there's one chapter where I'm talking about trade deficits, right? Or, you know, global imbalances. And these are really complicated. And honestly, when I was studying economics, I found them pretty impenetrable. But, you know, now I get it. And that means that I can then translate it back into normal speak. And so the way I think about it is, you know, you imagine two islands of people trading. One of them is selling video games software to the other, and the other one is selling the consoles, right? And so they both benefit from that exchange. But essentially, over time, it becomes imbalanced, and the accusations go that the country that is essentially importing too much, they're importing too many video games consoles, accuses the other one of selling them too many bargains, right? And this is basically the American complaint when it comes to China, right? They're accusing them of selling too much stuff and selling it for too cheap. And if you look at it from the other perspective, they're saying, what? You're complaining that we're sending you too much cheap stuff? That's insane, right? But really, it's both sides that are contributing to this imbalance.
Because I, of course, read that part when I was in, I think that's about chapter five. But you also added in as well, is that the party that is buying all of this stuff, that's buying as much of it as it is, of course, is funding it through debt. And the other party is lending that money. So therefore, it increases its level of control. So it certainly wasn't lost on me who you were talking about. But despite the fact that they were very accessible ideas, and, you know, you talk about the various different countries and you give analogies of boats and warships and merchant ships, etc., what I found you did, Sumay, is that you were really grappling as well with some of the philosophical concepts that comes with economics, down to the very basic element that economics is underpinned by, which is scarce resources. You can't do everything for everyone. And I'm just going to quote you a paragraph that you wrote yourself that I'd just like to get your thoughts on. You said, how should we think about combining the joy of a bargain with the grief of losing a good job, or synthesize the gains from slashing extreme poverty in poorer countries with the cost of dislocation in richer ones? And over, I found in the chapters, by the time you got to the end, there wasn't a clear outcome, but you had grappled with the philosophical choice that we have to make with the resources of the world along the way.
Yeah, completely. And again, thank you for reading it so deeply. I think there is this, you know, I think trade economics, I think for a long time, there's been this idea that, well, you know, trade has winners and losers, and you just got to compensate the losers and everything will be okay. And actually, I think in the real world, there are various problems with that, right? Often we can't compensate the losers, you know. And one of the lessons, I think, from the last two decades is that actually, you know, when you've got concentrated losers and they're very upset, it is just, you can have a situation that ends up being kind of captured by that narrative. People, when you ask people about trade, they get very, very upset about trade when they associate it with people losing jobs, right? And the kind of benefits in terms of cheaper prices, they don't necessarily notice those gains. Now, people today in the US, for example, are very upset because prices are rising, and you know they're unhappy about that. So I think, you know, maybe the lesson is that people are just very upset about a lot of things. But I suppose you're right. The point I was trying to make is that, you know, we haven't really got a framework that people can understand or accept that neatly combines those costs and benefits. Economists can try and do it, but, you know, it requires lots of assumptions, lots of modeling assumptions. It's really, really hard. And so at the end of the day, when you combine everything and you say, well, you know, on adjusted welfare terms, which no one understands really what that means, you know, trade makes you better off by 0.3% or whatever it is. that's not really going to translate to normal people.
And of course, as well, you really excellently weave politics into it. Politics and social reaction to politics. And just because somebody might be marginally better off if they see somebody else who is dramatically better off or worse off, then you can model all you like. People are going to feel a certain way. And then, of course, that can carry through. I want to move, though, to the very serious element of war, not trade war, actual war. And you talked, this was more so in the earlier part of the book, where you spoke about how trade can be used to weaponize dominance. And you were talking about how if one country is doing business with another, of which there's many, but then things go wrong, then it can raise the cost of conflict. Because then if the other country, let's say, is supplying into you or that you're selling into them and then something goes wrong with them and they're not able to either provide your goods or sell or buy the things from you, then that can have a really big impact. However, what I thought was interesting was the way you explored, though, a way in which to deal with that is to liberalise your trade with everybody else as distinct to your enemy. What led you to think about economics through the lens of war and then back into economic interdependence?
Yeah, so this is a really old and important debate when it comes to international relations, right? So on the one hand, you've got people who say that if countries trade with each other, that generates peace, right? Because as you say, when you've got strong economic ties, going to war with someone really hurts your economy, right? So high trade should lower the chances of war. On the other side, however, you've got the group who call themselves the realists, and they say, well, no, when you've got lots of trade, that could be unbalanced, and that could actually make people upset, right? Because they think that they're being exploited, there could be tensions, there's maybe a lack of trust, and those high trade flows can maybe be weaponized, that could lead to conflict. And so, you know, I think I got interested in this question because for a long time, it was sort of assumed that large trade flows would generate peace. That's been the recent assumption. And I think over the past few years, that assumption has really been questioned. You know, there are folks increasingly saying that was completely wrong. We were completely naive. And actually, if you see lots of trade flows together with peace, it's not the trade that's causing the peace. It's the peace that's causing the trade. Right. And that's the kind of really interesting philosophical question that it's incredibly difficult to answer and the kind of question that I'm attracted to. Now, I think the other reason I found it interesting is because economists have tried to answer that question. Right. So there have been empirical studies of economists looking at the data and saying, OK, well, can we see a relationship? And so there was one study that actually found that yes, when you've got two countries and they're trading with each other, those trade ties do seem to be associated with a lower chance of war, right? So that kind of confirms people's most people's baseline assumption as of a few years ago. But their finding was also that if you start liberalizing trade with other people, not with your main partner, that could actually increase the likelihood of war because you've got more other trading partners to kind of fall back on if something goes wrong with your main trading partner, right? And so that could kind of go the other way. So I think, you know, overall, where I ended, there were many times I was pretty tempted as I was researching this chapter to sort of throw my hands up and say, well, it's unknowable. What is truth? Who, you know, what can you say? I think overall, I do fundamentally buy into the idea that, you know, a world that is deeply connected is a safer world than one where countries are kind of isolated.
You did indeed say at the end of the chapter that you felt like throwing your hands up. And I was struck by the calendar of the time frame, because I think the latest reference that I saw would have been February. And I'm guessing February 2026 was not including the 28th of February 2026. So I was wondering, as you were writing that chapter, whether there was any semblance of how trade and all that has happened with trade in the context of what's gone on in Iran would come up. Because I was thinking, it couldn't possibly. Like, the book is almost out. It couldn't possibly. But another thing I wanted to ask you about.
But wait, can I just make a point there? Because so you're right. So we filed the book before the war in Iran broke out. But actually, the Iran war is a supportive example, right? There were years of sanctions. Iran was essentially, you know, being cut off from, you know, many of its neighbors, from the US. And in those circumstances, war is more likely, right? You know, the US hasn't started a war with China, which it's much more economically linked to. It did start a war with Iran, where those trade ties were much looser. So I think it does support that theory.
But if you look then at the secondary impact of closing the Strait of Hormuz, it absolutely supports the point and that whole point about liberalizing trade with other parts of the world as well. But yeah. I want to stick with that same geography. That's where I was going next to me anyway, because it comes up almost every chapter is the rise of China and how it's taking the world potentially by surprise. Like you describe China as furiously competitive, terrifyingly resilient and ravenously hungry for market share. And then you go on to give examples about in 2024, a quarter of the largest 500 companies in the world by revenue were Chinese. BYD, namely Build Your Dreams, sold more EVs than Tesla and a fifth of the world's total. Do you think, because I seem to be talking about this every week in here, that China's economic rise has taken the world by surprise?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, and you know, the big surprise was in the 2000s and you know, early 2010s, people thought of China as this producer of, you know, low value add commodities or you know, basic manufactured goods. You know, all of our, you know, children's toys, umbrellas, musical instruments, they all came from China. But, you know, the sophisticated stuff was coming from, say, Japan. We weren't expecting for China to, you know, really reach the frontier of innovation. And, you know, now we see that in some sectors, you know, electric vehicles, they're really at the front, right? And you've got conversations in Europe and in the US about, you know, oh dear, they've got tech that we want. How do we persuade them to share their tech, right? Whereas for years, the question was, well, how can the Chinese extract tech from the West? So I think that reversal in the conversation, the sudden realization that actually they've got ideas and know-how that we don't have. I think that's been the real surprise.
Well, I'm going to finish on another quote from the book that I think underpins the reason that one would read it. Apart from the fact that it's very accessible, it's very visual, you draw on countless global examples, far more global references than statistics, I would say. There's real stories in there. But it's this line stood out for me. And that is, if you misdiagnose the problem, you risk getting the solution wrong. And the whole book is around trade wars and its respective impact on people. And that very point, whether it's the ballot box, whether it's societal choices, whether it's home choices, etc. It's really, really well worth the read. I wish you the very best of luck with it, for sure. And thanks very much for joining us here on Taking Stock to speak about it. So Soumaya Keynes, I will now also add, of course, author of How to Win a Trade War.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the answer to this week's trivia. I was working with a group of entrepreneurs in a town this week, which has the name of a man in it who guided travellers across the River Shannon in the 10th century, has the oldest pub in Ireland, and the town crossed a border into another county until 1898. So that man's name is Lewin. The oldest pub is Sean's Bar, and it was established in 900 AD. And while mainly in Westmeath, part of this town was in County Roscommon until 1898, when Athlone was unified to be entirely within Westmeath at the time. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Ace Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully even learned something about economics and how it shapes and influences the world around us. A quick reminder, the show is available as a podcast first, every Friday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do pop it into your WhatsApp groups for anybody who might be interested. Taking Stock is also on air here on News Talk every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of the show is John Fardy. Research this week was by Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day and I'll talk to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.